You're watching Straight Talk Africa. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Hady Adams. Let's talk about the weather. Climate change is wreaking havoc worldwide. Poorer nations who contribute least to the problem are fighting a ferocious battle to cope with its effects. Is it time to change the way we think and talk about the global fight against climate change? What's fair and to whom? Who has a seat at the negotiation table? And who benefits most from climate investments? We look at what's behind the growing call for climate justice and energy equity across Africa. And we'll spotlight young African innovators and leaders who are taking climate action in their countries. Straight Talk Africa starts now. The 2015 Paris Climate Accords is an agreement between 197 countries to fight the effects of climate change, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and keep the Earth's temperature from rising by more than 2 degrees Celsius in this century. But how many countries are actually on track to meet those goals? The answer? One. And it's the West African nation of the Gambia. You may have seen the headlines. And in a few moments, we'll hear from one of that country's leading climate activists about what this news really means. But first, I want to talk about the ambitious movement taking shape at the southern edge of Africa's Sahara Desert. Countries in the Sahel region are building a great green wall across the entire width of Africa. Their goal is to hold back the world's largest desert by restoring 100 million hectares of land between Senegal in the west and Djibouti in the east. Now, for over a decade, communities most affected by desertification have been planting trees, vegetation, grasslands, and plants. And the project was first launched by the African Union in 2007. Now a film has been made about it, capturing the hopes of those working to make the Great Green Wall a reality.
Restoring the land is a matter of survival. It's up to us to create an African dream.
We're talking about revitalizing the ecosystem, the economy of communities and villages.
The future generation will hold us accountable.
The Great Green Wall, it's not just about planting trees. It has to become a movement from the whole continent, from the whole world.
And once completed, the Great Green Wall will be three times the size of Australia's Great Barrier Reef and the largest living structure on the planet. And the Gambia is part of this restoration project. While the West African country is being celebrated in news media as a global climate leader, one of its leading young conservationists says, let's not get too carried away. Kemo Fati wants more than big headlines. He says wealthy nations need to pay greater attention to African voices in financing the fight against climate change. He spoke to me recently from the Gambian capital of Banjul and told me why this fight is personal for him.
More than 6 years ago, my brother left for this migration. He actually tried to endeavor to get to Italy. So more and more, I see a lot of young people from this community here. Most of them have died in the Mediterranean. My brother, before he left, he put this sobering reflection to me that, Kemu, my great-grandfather was a farmer. My grandfather, a farmer, and my father, a farmer. They still could not pay a proper education for me. They still could not get themselves out of poverty. And €1 is equivalent of $50. What am I doing in this country? Because for me, it was an irony that, you know, hundreds of years ago, the Europeans were at the shores of the Atlantic, you know, packing us by force into those boats. And what happens? years later, and they don't need to come to the shores of the Atlantic. We deliberately pack ourselves in probably much more harsh conditions than the slave owners because they needed us to be alive. But this time around, we just take all the risk and jump into these boats. So I didn't feel comfortable as a young person. So when they say they're looking for greener pasture, I started figuring out ways to make the pasture green. And this brought in the whole issue of climate change. I then realized that, of course, these changes that are happening, what is causing these people to leave is the consistent production of the land, and that has ultimately diminished the productivity of the soil. More and more, these people go deeper into poverty because 70% of all the people living here are depending on agriculture. So I didn't see any stronger motivation than protecting what's left of our land. Even if I can't do much at the global sphere, I think what's remaining, the life support systems that we have in our ecosystem, is something I need to preserve so that when I have children, it can be a fair deliverance to show them the world like I have met it. But our parents and our great-grandparents have not handed this over to us. So I didn't find a much more important job than to take this as my life's work and ensure that, you know, our biodiversity is protected.
Kemo, what does climate justice mean to you?
Well, if I come to think of climate justice, I think basically it's not just looking at climate change as an environmental issue, but of course, you know, as a social issue as well. You know, we look at most of the inequities that are surrounding the whole climate issue. For instance, you know, when we look at the large polluters, you know, they are polluting so much in terms of climate change. But like you said, most of them are sitting in cities. You know, they are being fed from the hard-earned works of cocoa farmers here in Africa, in India. So all of these people who are marginalized, they are facing the harsh impacts of this climate change. For instance, if you are rich here in the Gambia, you can buy your air conditioner or whatsoever and then avoid this, the heat stressors. But the local people who have no idea of this climate change and polluting this carbon are the people who are facing the heat stressors, are the people who are hardest hit by disasters, are the people who are struggling to put food on the table. When we look at the Gambia, for instance, we have an ambitious nationally determined contribution. We have, you know, the ambition to actually, you know, phase out from fossil fuels. We have the ambition to reduce our emissions. But, you know, this comes with finance. And we are not the people putting all of this carbon into the atmosphere. So that means now we are taking resources that could have been spent on other sectors, education, you know, some kind of poverty relief, even though climate is affecting poverty. The government is trying to direct them towards climate action. So I think this is what climate justice entails, you know, making sure that the largest polluters, they pay for their pollution so that, you know, we can ensure that the people who are, you know, most vulnerable also have some sort of relief. And of course, you know, are also able to put up some adaptation mechanisms to help themselves to thrive.
What do you think is missing from the conversation in Africa, specifically about climate change?
Well, in Africa, I think what is missing, if you ask me as a conservationist, I would say is our take on water, specifically here in the Sahel. Our priorities are on adaptation, not mitigation. So what is missing is that the people are not really focused on the water shortages that are coming up in the near future. You know, we looked at Lake Chad, for instance. You know, we've seen almost 80 to 90% of the lake has been shrinking. We look at, for instance, the very country where I am in currently, the Gambia, we have the OMVG project. One of our freshwater sources is the River Gambia that gets its source from the Futajolan Highlands. So instead of investing into renewable energy that has to deal with the sun, we are building a dam that will certainly affect the flow of fresh water. You know, once we lose water, we will lose the entire Sahel to the desert. More and more, we see the desert creeping in. And this is a crisis of water. In the world, they are racing against a 1.5 degrees. But here in the Sahel, we are racing against water because we only have 3 months of rainfall here in the Gambia. From 6 months, it has reduced to 3 months over the period of a generation. So we are seeing that, you know, more and more farmers are having problems with planting. More disasters come because we don't know when to plant. So at the end of the day, you know, this is having a huge economic burden. But yet still, we keep putting our freshwater sources in places that you cannot imagine. the economic growth model in the Western world is changing, you know, to power some of their old plants on renewable energy. But it seems as if in Africa we are repeating the same mistakes of the Europeans who are trying to now shift to renewable energy. We are now building our foundation on fossil fuels. We are allowing companies and business to thrive on not clean energy, even if they are new. I think what should be included in this is ensuring that we have some policies in place to really see that when companies or any new thing is coming, that they are built 100% on renewable energy, because we are trying to transition. But because this doesn't favor their growth model, this doesn't favor investors, so everybody turns a blind eye to it. You know, more and more, they just want jobs, but how these jobs are created, nobody is looking into the nitty-gritties of this.
What do you think is missing from the larger global conversation on the issue?
So for the world itself, I think what's missing is in terms of climate finance. They said that they are going to mobilize $100 billion. You know, has that been done yet? There has been several disastrous COPs that have been happening. And we've seen that, you know, in all of this climate financing, only 3% is spent on nature-based solutions. With all what nature is doing for us, absorbing the carbon, giving us the livable planet, this nature is what is actually taking most of the carbon for us. And yet only 3% of global climate financing is going into nature-based solutions. So this is a critical and a sobering reflection for us as young people and for the leaders themselves. Because at the end of the day, the people who are doing the spending at this global sphere, for instance, when we talk about in Africa, we talk about the Agenda 2063. There is nobody at the African Union who will probably be alive by 2063. You know, by 2063, I would have already been retired. So how can we ensure accountability? How do they decide for us the future? Nobody asked me if I want to pay debts that they are putting into fossil fuel economies, but today I'm here paying for it. Nobody is going to ask my children for that, but they will still face that. So we are saying that if the world is looking at, you know, transforming itself, you know, we need to put into perspective those people we are making decisions on behalf of, that these decisions are not something that take away their livelihood or create a world that we don't know altogether.
Kemo, I want to ask you how you felt hearing the news about your country, that Gambia is the only country in the world which is on track to meet the Paris Accords.
Well, I think that is just to say that as a climate activist, personally, you know, that is just a reminder. We want to send a message out to world leaders, you know, developed economies, that, you know, as small as we are and the fact that our contribution is marginal, we want you guys to step up just as much as we have. You know, it's quite sad for us to be the only country living up to the Paris Agreement. So at some point, you know, it's having this nostalgic feeling of, you know, yes, okay, we are doing well. Should I celebrate? No, because our contributions are completely insignificant when it comes to emissions. So therefore, this is just a symbol showing how unwilling, you know, developed economies are in trying to scale up ambition. But as a country itself, you know, of course, you know, despite the fact that we are leaving to Paris Agreement, there is also certain issues when it comes to the destruction of nature within here, just that we are not that large, but also these are sets that need to be really looked into, you know, for us to be fully living in conformity with this. One example I would give you is the illegal logging. For instance, in the Gambia, we are responsible for most of the logging that happens in southern Senegal, that is in the Casamance region. You know, we have amassed tons and tons of wealth by, you know, the heads of states here, you know, in terms of exporting this illegal wood. And most of this wood that they are even cutting are part of the endangered species, such as the rosewood. We are expecting more actions. You know, we are expecting our states to actually put more attention on the nature that is around us. We want, first of all, to take care of the small things before we can, you know, celebrate the big things. So this is my reaction to that. But overall, I would like to congratulate the Gambia for that significant achievement, because at the end of the day, it's like paving way for the rest of the world to actually follow suit, and knowing that, you know, this is not just about Gambia or something. It's about humanity. It's our survival as, you know, human beings. We are the only species altering the, you know, the earth systems. So at the end of the day, for us, you know, we are happy to take the lead, and a call to action for other countries to step up.
And that was conservationist Kemo Fati speaking to me from the Gambian capital of Banjul. Now, a big source of greenhouse gases that is changing the climate is the production of electricity. More than half of the 1.2 billion people living in sub-Saharan Africa do not have access to power. And as African countries look to generate more electricity, it seems like the perfect opportunity to leapfrog to wind, solar and other types of renewable energy and move away from dirty fuels like coal, gas and oil, right? But it's not that simple. Some countries are in a prime position to make the switch. But is it affordable and practical throughout Africa? I asked Lily Odano from the Clean Air Task Force here in Washington for some answers. Lily Odano, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, and we're going to get right into it. Now, we often hear about the risks of climate change to the world's most vulnerable nations, and of course, especially those in sub-Saharan Africa, where we are also hearing the call for climate justice. Lily, what is the climate injustice in the world right now?
Great question. And I think many of us are familiar with the recent happenings in Madagascar, where a four-year drought has literally plunged over a million people on the island nation into very severe food insecurity. And to me, while the threat of climate vulnerability is becoming ever more apparent, as we are seeing with events in Madagascar and the devastating effects of Cyclone Idai on Mozambique in 2019, I think the greatest climate injustice is the fact that the very countries that are the most vulnerable to climate change also have the least bargaining power in international climate negotiations. And a classic example or expression of this inequity is in the disbursement of climate finance. So at COP15 in 2009, wealthier countries pledged to support less developed countries to adapt to the impacts of climate change and to mitigate emissions by transitioning to clean energy sources. Well, what has happened so far? So far, this is a promise that has gone unfulfilled. And we still have about a $20 billion shortfall as of 2018, I believe. And while the developing countries requested for an even split of climate finance between adaptation measures and mitigation measures, what we have seen is that a lion's share of climate finance, up to about 70%, has gone to mitigation efforts. That's looking at emissions reduction efforts. And this is compared to about 20%, which has gone into adaptation efforts, which could have helped countries like Madagascar and Mozambique better prepare for the crises that have befallen them. And this is not all. Climate finance is largely dispersed as loans to developing countries. In 2018, up to three quarters of climate finance was dispersed as loans. And these are not cheap loans. The data shows that in the same year, over 60 countries who access climate finance loans borrowed at interest rates which were over 18%. And these were for projects which were lasting more than 2 years. So by their very design, the terms of climate finance tend to exclude the most vulnerable populations and countries. So what we are seeing is that middle-income countries have received the lion's share of climate finance, while the least developed countries, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa and the small island states, have received the least. And I think this must really change. And I hope that the issue of equitable climate finance makes a really big show at COP26 in Glasgow.
Now, one of the first things that US President Joe Biden did when he came into office was to reverse the Trump administration's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. Lily, what has been the effect of both of those decisions on the global fight against climate change?
To start off, the decision by the Biden administration to return to the Paris Agreement is very commendable. And I think it is a very welcome demonstration of the administration's prioritization of climate, which is very, very much needed. Very recently, the US and the EU also launched a global pledge to reduce methane emissions by 30% within this decade, which is yet another demonstration of climate ambition. This obviously stands in stark contrast to what we saw under the Trump administration. But I do think that it's also important to mention that even under the previous administration, when the U.S. pulled out of International Climate Cooperation and leadership, U.S. states, U.S. cities, and the private sector really stepped up their game and made very positive steps that filled the vacuum that had been created. So rejoining the Paris Agreement, I will say, by the Biden administration is the first step. And the United States can do more. I think that the United States can back its commitment with stronger efforts to address the climate finance inequities that I raised earlier. Between 2010 and 2015, the U.S. mobilized up to $15 billion of climate finance. President Obama in 2014 also pledged a $3 billion contribution to the Green Climate Fund to help developing countries respond to climate change. Of that, $1 billion has been added to date. So there's still some work to be done here, aside re-entering the Paris Agreement.
I want to talk now about energy and this switch from fossil fuels to renewable and clean energy that Africa is expected to make. What are the greatest energy challenges on the African continent today? And is renewable clean energy 100% the answer to Africa's energy needs as the continent not only seeks to electrify its people, but as it seeks to develop and to the same extent that countries in the West have?
Excellent question. And I love it because I think it sits really at the heart of the energy and climate discussion or discourse in Africa. First of all, Africa needs to grow and Africa needs to provide its people with decent standards of living, and energy will be fundamental to that. By 2040, we expect Africa's population to grow to over 2 billion people compared to about 1.3 billion people today. We expect Africa's urban areas to grow. By 2050, the estimates are that we could have 60% of Africans living in urban areas. Africa is looking to scale up and to ramp up investments in manufacturing by 2030. We are looking at a 40% increase in manufacturing on the continent by 2030. This means that energy demand could grow very rapidly, and estimates are that it could even grow by a factor of about 100% by 2040. So I think that the question at hand is really, what power systems can support these levels of growth? And I say that utility-scale power systems will be relevant to Africa's development and energy future. And to that, wind, solar, and storage, they will potentially account for a significant share of Africa's future energy systems, but by themselves, they are unlikely to meet the growing energy needs of African economies as we industrialize. So this means that African countries who currently depend on fossil fuels for firm power, and when I say firm power, I'm talking about power that is always available 24/7, these African countries will need other options, other zero carbon firm options to be able to power their economies as they grow. And we need to begin thinking big and thinking about laying the foundation for pathways that allow us to adopt a broader set of zero carbon firm power options on the continent. We should be looking at how African countries can implement these alternative technologies as they become cost effective and feasible for our African markets. We should be looking at how our next generation of young people can play an active role in shaping Africa's energy future.
But Lily, is it fair to ask Africa to develop with clean energy when many wealthier nations industrialized with dirty fuels, and that's what put us in the position we are today? And is there necessarily a huge desire among African countries to make the transition to renewables early on and avoid the mistakes of Western nations? Or do some want to go the way of Asian countries that chose to industrialize first and essentially clean up later?
Yeah, interesting one there. It's important for us to recognize the fact that, you know, African countries are embarking on the clean energy transition journey from very different starting points. So if we take a country like Ethiopia, which is endowed with vast zero emissions energy resources, we are talking hydro, we are talking geothermal, the pathway to a net zero future, it's easily discernible in that context. Now contrast that with Nigeria, which is a big hydrocarbon dependent economy. The transition pathways for these two countries are light years apart. For the hydrocarbon-rich economy, African countries, we have to acknowledge that the transition to a zero-carbon economy will not happen overnight. I think what these countries need more than anything else are options, and they need the options now to help them decarbonize without having to sacrifice their development aspirations. But it's important also to have in mind that while we abate emissions in the short term, we still need to start laying that foundation for zero carbon options in these same economies so that there are options to transition to when these countries have to move on. And again, I would want to emphasize the relevance of having firm power that is able to support industrialization at scale. You know, when we think of the burden to decarbonize in Africa, decarbonizing Africa's fossil fuel sector, I think it must not be left to African countries alone. The biggest consumers of Africa's hydrocarbon resources really are primarily the European Union and China. And I believe that this is a time when we have to begin thinking collectively about how we work together with these countries. So the EU, China working collectively with the African producing economies to decarbonize the fossil fuel sector. I think this is a time for shared responsibility if we want to be serious about climate change.
And I'll have more from my conversation with Lily Udano from the Clean Air Task Force after the break. We'll also talk about jobs. Will a switch to clean energy create more jobs or more job losses? And later we'll bring you the story of a Kenyan scientist who uses artificial intelligence and indigenous knowledge to help farmers adapt to climate change. Back in a moment.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. Is there a way to combat climate change and Africa's unemployment problems at the same time? Here's more now from my conversation with Lily Udano from the Clean Energy Task Force here in Washington. Lily, as you know, we have a huge unemployment problem on the continent. Let me use the example here of South Africa. You know, it has one of the highest unemployment rates in the world. And its economy is still largely driven by coal. So what would a switch to renewable energy mean for workers in that country? Would there be jobs for them in a clean energy economy?
Yes, I think South Africa is a great choice for this topic because South Africa's energy transition is a very complicated one. Primarily, we are all familiar with the country's deep dependence on coal. And South Africa's coal sector employs about 200,000 people. You're looking at coal mines, in coal power plants, and in coal transport. So looking ahead, employment in South Africa's coal mines is set for a downward trend, of course, due to automation, due to the retirement of coal power plants, and also due to shrinking export markets as we decarbonize the global energy system. Now, the truth is that the displaced coal workers will likely struggle to find new jobs. And this is because of South Africa's history with high unemployment rates fundamentally. So the question really is, and I think that's what you're asking, will these workers be able to pivot to the renewable sector? in South Africa, what we are seeing is that, especially in the solar industry, is that solar panel manufacturing is still being largely done in China. The country is not yet there with having local production lines that can produce solar panels at competitive price points and at a scale where it will be employing a lot of people. Since many enterprises in the renewable energy sector are young, they do not have the degree of unionization that we are used to seeing with South Africa's mining industries and mining unions. We need to plan for how workers are going to shift from jobs which were more permanent to some which could be more temporary. But we also need to think of how we reskill workers to be able to take up new tasks in the renewable energy economy.
And Lily, will we see enough jobs in the clean energy sector to counter this threat of job losses for those working in the coal, oil and gas sectors?
I think that the concerns about job losses are valid. There are going to be job losses as we shift from a fossil economy into the renewables economy. But the renewable energy economy is also going to create new jobs. I do think that in the African context, what is relevant most is really that manufacturing piece and how Africa can play a greater role in that, because that forms a big part of the job markets that will be created in the renewable energy space. Now, if we have all of that happening overseas, then we lose a huge opportunity to be able to transition folks from a coal economy or from a gas economy or whichever fossil economy it is to a renewable energy economy. Think about what the broader impacts on the economy are. Well, what are the broader impacts on people? What are the broader impacts on families? What are the broader impacts on jobs? And we need to really think about how we begin to position ourselves to be able to take advantage of the shift to a renewable energy economy. We have the youngest growing workforce in the world. How do we harness this young workforce into a renewable energy economy? Do we have to regionalize our production of these resources to make them cost competitive? How do we think creatively about this? I hope that these are discussions which will be taken up not just at the country level, but through our regional blocks in West Africa, in East Africa, for us to think of how we create opportunities through stronger regional cooperation so we are able to scale up jobs for our young workforce.
And Lily, are there any standout examples of African countries with the best strategies and infrastructure in place and who are showing the greatest commitment to transitioning to renewable energy?
My personal favorite example is Kenya. The country's experience shows how, you know, one country has managed to elevate the role of geothermal energy in power production. And I think it's interesting because primarily in Africa, baseload power has come from hydro, we know of biomass. Geothermal we've known the potential, but it hasn't been, of course, it's regionally located, so it hasn't been a big part of our energy discussions. But today, Kenya generates nearly half of its electricity from geothermal power plants. And like many other regions many other countries in the region, Kenya historically also depended on hydro, on oil-powered thermal plants, but the country saw the potential for an alternative and went for it. So the Okaria geothermal facility, which is the oldest facility and was the first geothermal facility on the African continent, it was built 40 years ago more as a research endeavor rather than as a commercial enterprise. But now it forms the backbone of Kenya's electricity grid. I think this is extremely inspiring. And for me, it gives me hope that African countries can be leaders in the clean energy transition, and African countries can lead in opening up opportunities for zero carbon power options on the continent. I think what we need is the vision and the leadership to get us there. And Kenya has proven that it's possible. So they remain, so far, a good and a great example for me.
You know, on this talk about solar energy, and I'm going to go back to my context in South Africa. You know, whenever growing up, I would see solar panels, they would be just about everywhere in wealthy neighborhoods and just about nowhere in poorer neighborhoods. Are solar panels affordable and accessible in some places that we might not realize? I mean, I've always associated them with affluence, but that's just from my experience in urban South Africa.
So I think, and I agree with you, this is a very interesting description of solar panels and the connection to affluence. And I think it goes to, you know, the core of when we look at the decentralized systems, what levels of service do they bring to communities and to homes and to businesses? I think that for communities which are very far away from the grid, distributed systems play a role in bringing first-time access. And we have seen the prices of these systems drop dramatically over the years. We have seen interesting business models come up from, you know, pay-as-you-go to, you know, rentals. And, you know, we have really, really interesting models. And I think you have alluded to basically the host of problems that we face in our energy systems, you know, from ranging from inefficiencies on the side of utilities to, you know, who even has access to the decentralized sources. I do think that we need to really rethink our energy economy, and we need to, you know, open up the space for civic engagement around what communities need and what communities look for also in government, in our utilities. What technologies would make sense? How do we build wealth so that people are able to pay for the power that they are using? How do we stimulate productive activity within that? And how do we make utilities more functional? I know that many people are really frustrated with African utilities, but I do not think that, you know, we can leave utilities behind as we grow and as we navigate the clean energy transition. We still need utilities. And I will give you an example why. So if you take countries in West Africa, for instance, most of them have very different resource endowments. So some of the landlocked African countries, all that they have for power sources they have to depend on thermal generation and expensive crude oil. Now, these countries could be very close to other countries which have very rich hydro-based resources, for instance. Now, if we are able to have functional utilities and have better functioning regional markets, countries who do not have resources or are not able to access clean power cost effectively can benefit from those who are able to produce it more cheaply. I think that we need to focus more on how energy links to the end users. So how does energy change the ability of people to be able to, you know, have a small enterprise in their homes? How does energy scale manufacturing so that these communities are able to get jobs in these factories and now are able to actually pay for power in their homes and take care of their kids? So the story is bigger than, you know, having one singular technology or not. It's about a holistic development and energy story. And how successfully we do that depends on how we are able to weave those two threads together.
And that was my conversation with Lily Odano, Director of Energy and Climate Innovation for Africa at the Clean Energy Task Force here in Washington. This week, we're shining a spotlight on who we call Africa's climate change makers. They're young conservationists, activists, and innovators who say it's time to change the way we think and talk about climate change in Africa. And that sometimes the message and solutions need to come from Africans themselves. Here are Kenya's Elizabeth Watuti and Nigeria's Glory Oguegbu.
I have always been passionate about environmental conservation, and especially having grown up in the most beautiful forests in Kenya. And this is a region that is actually the most forested. It's called Nyeri County. And my childhood memories include having spent a lot of time close to clean streams and close to beautiful forests, and gave me this natural connection with nature. And I remember a time when I also witnessed ecological grief, where trees that my friends and I had planted as children were cut down. I went into this forest and all I could find were tree logs and tree stumps, and this made me feel so angry. And since then, it then became a personal fight a personal connection with nature, and it also became something that I always love to do each and every day. So I decided to found the Green Generation Initiative to nurture young people to love nature and to be environmentally conscious at a young age, because I do believe it's that connection with nature that made me love nature, and in the process made me always be on the front line to protect nature. And this initiative focuses on creating a generation of environmentally conscious individuals, because at the end of the day, it's about the collective actions of every individual right now that are going to help us shape this for the better. Last year, during one of the Fridays for Future climate strikes, I held this poster where I had written down, "The climate is changing, why aren't we?" And I held this poster in Nairobi City. And this is because of the many years of inaction that we have continued to see. A lot of young people like myself have continued to demand for urgent and bold climate action from the leaders. But yet much of the needed change and actions that we want to see seem to be nowhere in the horizon. And so I wrote this poster because I began to witness a lot of the climate change impact my own country. People were dying and losing their lives as a result of the floods, mudslides, and landslides that were affecting different parts of the country. I care about how my actions will impact the next generations. But yet, as the human race, we are not doing what is supposed to be done of us to be reduce, or rather to be able to tackle this crisis and reduce these impacts from the people that are the most affected. Just because the climate crisis is not happening where you are, it doesn't mean that it's not happening at all. There are people that have to deal with the worst impacts of this crisis every day. And for that reason, we also need to change and begin to take urgent action. And the other aspect is the peace of nature. Nature has to be at the center of climate conversations, and that has not happened for a long time. And this is because the discussions about tackling the climate crisis have only a lot of times been centering around reducing carbon emissions. For us to stay within the 1.5 degrees Celsius, we also need to preserve every bit of remaining ecosystems, and they have to stay intact, and as well as continue with nature regeneration efforts, and also make sure that our cities are green, clean, and resilient. I would want an Africa where people do not have to deal with the worst impacts of climate change, an Africa that is resilient, an African continent where everybody can be able to afford and have a decent meal every day, and also a continent where of equal access to green spaces, equal access to clean drinking water as well, and an African continent whereby people will not have to really struggle in life in terms of the incomes, and in terms of the fact that we see every day women who have to walk for long distances to look for water and food for their families, and that should not happen. We need to show global solidarities to continents like Africa to make sure that climate change adaptation and mitigation is at the center of the climate conversations as well.
Indeed, there were climate change impacts, but we do not recognize them as climate change impacts in Nigeria. And if we wanted to begin the journey of combating climate change, we have to bridge that gap first. The people have to know what is going on, not just knowing what is going on, but understanding how this thing is going on in their country and how this thing affects them as a person. So on the normal day, Nigerian people are quite stubborn. They would not take any action against climate change if they did not see people dropping dead on the streets. I know a lot of people in Nigeria who cook with biomass. Now, the smoke that comes out from that firewood is aiding climate change. Not just that, it's even having other effects. How can I tell this woman that climate change is happening? Western literature has not helped. Telling the woman that polar bears are disappearing and that ices are melting across the world and that there is sea level rise and that the elephants have died does not make sense to an African. What I have learned in my journey is that people take action faster when they see how that problem is affecting them. It has to reach home before they can really take action faster. Then I could tell the woman who also has a farm nearby that your cassava has not done so well because there's been changes in the environment. There is a change that is happening in our world that is leading to that. Only then can the person listen to you to understand what climate change is and if there are steps that they can take, because there's a personal way it affected them, it affects them. Understanding climate change and understanding the steps that you need to take, the changes that you need to make in your life to make sure that we live in a sustainable world. Bringing it down to your very local experience, bringing it down to your very home. There are things that you do every day in your life that generate carbon dioxide, which is one of the most important greenhouse gases that aids climate change. But now we're telling people to be climate smart. We're telling people to stop those things. But how can we achieve a balance? It is by taking certain steps that have been proven, making little changes within those things that you're doing so that it's not having the same amount of impact to the environment. That's why I write a lot about climate change. I have a blog where I send to young people all the time to read so they can understand what's going on. I believe that education is paramount. Education will help people understand what the problem is and how to solve it before they even know what to do and take the action.
What fascinating young ladies. It's time now for a short break, and when Stray Dog Africa returns, we'll show you how indigenous knowledge helps communities on opposite sides of the world cope with the changing climate. Stay with us. When Muthoni Masinde became a computer scientist, she wanted to help small-scale farmers like her mother adapt to the changing climate and cope with its effects. Growing up in a remote village in Kenya, she saw firsthand the challenges of small-scale farming. Using science and technology, along with the indigenous knowledge she learned from her mother, Masinde created Itiki, a mobile drought prediction tool. Itiki is already helping more than 15,000 farmers in Kenya, South Africa, and Mozambique. This is the story of Africa's weather maven.
When I was young, as 8 years old, and I learned a lot of natural science that were using to make cropping decisions. One of the ones that fascinated me most is the one of the cows, especially just before the rain season. If they came home jumping with their tails up, it meant a lot of rain for his coming. Or the one where, depending on what mango tree was flowering more, it meant that it's either bumper harvest or mega harvest. For example, when the mango tree that naturally produces bigger mangoes flowered, it meant a huge season is coming. And the one that is very interesting, and I don't skip giving it as an example, is the behavior of dragonflies. They come dancing around during, just before the season. If they are flying very high up, let's say like 3 meters, that would indicate like 3 weeks before the rain comes. The moment they fly very low, like 1 foot from the ground, in a few days, 3 days, it would rain. So what I noticed is that the indigenous knowledge has been affected tremendously by climate change. So some of the things they depended on do not work anymore. But on the other hand, when I was doing my PhD, I came across the artificial intelligence, which you can use to predict future trends. And also I learned a lot of meteorological knowledge. So I decided I'm going to try and combine those two knowledge systems so that one can enhance the other. The marriage of the two meant a better focus system for the farmers and anyone else that would want to use the knowledge from our system. ITIKIFAST is an acronym. The first IT is for information technology that represents everything computer science. The IK is for indigenous knowledge. And the last I is for intelligence. So what happens is that we developed a mobile app. The farmers, we call them champions. We've given them smartphones. So they record on real-time basis those indicators. If today they have observed ants moving on a straight line, they'll caption that, take the picture, and send it to us. And this has spread across the region where we offer the service. And then at the end of the day, on a real-time basis, again, all these indicators are collated. We also do have access, on the other hand, of the conventional weather data. Those two knowledge systems, we combine them using artificial intelligence and come up with a forecast. And what I mean by forecast, we give them three types of forecast. There is a short-term one that tells them within the next 2 weeks what's going to happen. So something like it's going to rain next week on Wednesday. We also give them medium-term decisions. Cumulatively, this is going to be a very good season, so you can comfortably plant your maize. Or this is going to be a less stronger season, you better plant something like millet that will survive in this less rain. Finally, we do give them long-term decisions, and this is where the conventional science comes in. You can tell them 2 seasons from now. So we were in September of 2021. It's possible to tell them September of 2022. What will it be like? And what can they use that information for? To me, indigenous knowledge is the key to adaptation, because if you just empower them a little bit, they will be able to use that which they already know and adapt to the environment where they're living. And more importantly, it's because if you have a solution that embraces their indigenous knowledge, they are most likely going to use the solution. I feel so proud of the fact that I'm a living example of what the African Union calls African solutions, but African people. It works. It works in no other way, because it starts with me, ends with me, and it touches our people. So I'm very proud. I'm growing more people like me. Many people I'm mentoring, and I always remind them, remember your roots. Remember you're unique. Remember my village is driven from your village, and it's only you who can bring a difference in that village. So I look forward to more Africans embracing that African Union slogan so that we solve all problems.
And that's how you do it. Meanwhile, on the opposite side of the world, Hawaiians are also turning to traditional practices for insight on coping with climate change. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan explains from Honolulu.
Rising ocean waters are causing erosion, threatening coastal Hawaiian homes. Oahu, the state's principal island, could lose 40% of its beaches from erosion by 2050, says one study. Harming tourism, the largest source of income for the islands. Another problem, higher temperatures are causing erratic precipitation and, in places, drought.
Some rainfall is on average going up over time, some is going down. In Hawaii, we've actually seen drying out.
With less stable weather, the islands are seeing more severe storms and flooding, as in Maui in March. There are other impacts, too.
Groundwater wells near the coast, agriculture, infrastructure.
A modern urban center, Honolulu, has paved over waterways to control flooding, blocking natural watersheds that once linked the mountains, wetlands, and coast in a single ecosystem. Native Hawaiians called it Ahupua'a.
And we're standing in front of an Ahupua'a. And the Ahupua'a was the Native Hawaiian system of managing resources from ridge to reef.
Hawaii now imports most of its food, but there are efforts to renew traditional farming and conservation methods, including here on the eastern or windward shore of Oahu. Nick Rapoon works for a nonprofit group that grows traditional staple foods like taro and is restoring this lowland area to its natural state. Other groups are restoring the mountain watershed and an aquaculture pond where Native Hawaiians once raised fish.
We're just trying to do what we know has been done and what we know worked before. We're not reinventing the wheel with these systems. We're just trying to, I guess, revive them.
Alapaki Luke, who teaches Hawaiian language and culture, says taro patches trap silt and control erosion, something Native Hawaiians understood. That traditional wisdom is important, he says.
I'm not about going back 400 or 500 years ago, but we can use the foundation, which you call a kahua, of the Ike, the Native tradition, in a modern setting.
Luke says the traditional practices that once supported a population of hundreds of thousands on these islands still have much to teach us. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Honolulu.
Be sure to join me on the next Straight Talk Africa. What does a free and fair election really look like? And what are the actual signs of a rigged voting system? We'll look at examples from across Africa, the Americas, and other parts of the world. And we'll examine whether complaints about elections and efforts to thwart voting rights can make people lose faith in democracy. Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa. And that is where we will leave it for this week. Thank you to all my guests for sharing their stories and perspectives with us. From the Straight Talk Africa team, I thank you for always watching and always listening. Until next time, goodbye.